Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Roshi, for those kind words and this invitation, this opportunity to be with you again. I believe this is the first of a two-part talk, so I'll be with you again in 2 weeks. And what I'd like to talk about today is not focused so much on social engagement, that'll be more next time. But this time, more about basic issues of personal, individual practice. When I was in my late 30s, a long time ago, I suddenly became very interested in death. Not sure why. No one close to me had died or diagnosed with anything terminal. Maybe it was just what Carl Jung said, getting older, that second part of life. Anyway, being an intellectual professorial sort, of course, what I did was read everything I could find. In Zen and Buddhism, for sure, but also other spiritual traditions, philosophy, and psychology. And the book that touched me most deeply, and I can say it really changed my life, was this one by a cultural anthropologist named Ernest Becker. Maybe some of you might be familiar with it, right? Becker talks a lot about psychoanalysis, psychotherapy. And at that time, when he wrote the book, mid-70s, Freud was sort of at his ascendance, a very important figure. And in particular, he focused on the concept, Freud and Becker both, focused on the concept of repression. The idea of repression is that there's some thought, feeling, desire, memory, something, some mental event that makes us uncomfortable. And so we push it away, or you could say we suppress it. For better or worse, that repression doesn't usually work very well. Freud talks about the return of the repressed. You push it down, but it fine and it returns often in a disguised form. Not necessarily obvious that it's the same. It's that it returns as a symptom. And it's not always obvious the connection between the symptom and what it is that we're repressing. For Freud, what he emphasized was sexuality, sexual desires. And I think that may have had something to do with the Victorian, Edwardian era when he grew up in, right? For Freud, our fundamental repression was sexual desire, right? And he saw this acting out in a lot of his women patients, their kind of neurotic symptoms. Well, growing up in the 60s, that didn't seem to be the main repression, right? Then Becker comes along, right? And he says, no, that's not the real repression. The real repression is the fact that we're going to die. And we don't like to think about that. In fact, not, it's deeper than that. If we were fully aware of what our mortality means, we would literally go crazy. We could not function. So we repress it on a daily level in order to cope. But the return of the repressed, how does the return of the repressed function? Well, for example, David Loy, okay, I'm a human being. I know that I'm going to die someday, right? Don't always like to think about it, but and then I find like it's really, really important. I become compulsive or obsessed with writing this great book, this immortal book that will make my name immortal, right? Like my training is in philosophy. So maybe write a philosophy book that people will read after I'm dead, right? I'll be one of the greats. Maybe. Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, and David Loy. Right. It made a lot of sense. But I realized from a Zen or a Buddhist point of view, actually, it was a little bit not quite. It's like Buddhism offered a some slightly different perspective on it, right? The idea that what we're afraid of, something that's inevitably going to happen to us in the future, right? The Buddhist teaching about no self, non-self, right? If you know early Buddhism, anatta, the no self teaching. For Buddhism, the fundamental issue isn't the fact that we're going to die sometime in the issue. It's the fact that this sense of self that we have isn't real right now. In modern language, we can say that our sense of self or ego self, it's a psychological and social construct composed of mostly habitual ways of thinking and feeling and acting and remembering and planning and tending. It's the way that a bunch of these, and notice their processes, right? The way these processes work together. Very interesting. You can say the sense of self isn't a thing. It's a confluence of processes that reinforce, right? There's the concept of an I and all the things that sort of work together that the I is supposedly experiencing and doing. It's interesting that infants aren't born with a sense of self, are they? A little baby doesn't have a sense of self. That's something that develops as we grow up. We're socialized. We learn to see ourselves the way that other people see us. We learn to see ourselves the way our mother or parents see us, right? My mom calls me David. I learn to identify with that David, right? And so there's this. We grow up learning to fit into the way society is organized, that we're one more thing, you know, born at a certain time, living at a certain time, dying. It's like we have a place and a role in that, and we're one more of those things. Right. And Buddhism says no, there's a fundamental delusion here. A delusion that causes a great deal of suffering because this I, this supposed I, because it's a function, a bunch of processes, because it doesn't have any reality of its own, is it is inherently insecure. Our sense of self is insecure. Not only that, but there's nothing there that could be secured. That's why it's insecure, right? The sense of self being a function of thing, it doesn't have any reality of its own. And this comes out. This lack of reality, self-existence of the self. This is, you know, we repress it and it comes out. The repressed returns as a sense of lack. LACK. By lack, I mean the sense that something is missing. Something is wrong with me. Something isn't quite right. I'm not good enough. Anyone here ever feel that? Of course, it doesn't return in such a general sense. It tends to be more specific. There's something that we lack, right? I think traditionally, this goes a long way to explain the attraction of religion, right? I mean, you think I was raised a Catholic, right? Sin, we inherit the original sin of Adam and Eve. Yeah, definitely something wrong with me called sin, you know, but if we believe in God and do what the church says, then there's going to be a solution to it after we die, right? Or we can have the comfort of the faith in believing that, right? Of course, in the modern world, where maybe a lot of educated people don't believe in that kind of a God anymore, how do we experience our sense of lack in more secular terms? Especially in a country like the United States, where we are so much more individualized, right? We're not extended families. There's a certain, you have a role and support there, right? But in the US, we're so individuated, which means, I think, that a stronger sense of separate self means a stronger sense of lack, this feeling something isn't right. Now, parenthetically, I think that can help to understand a lot of political polarization right now. Not that I want to get into that for the moment, but you know, what's wrong with my life? Well, it's those Democrats or something like that, right? But I think it's important for us to recognize what we might call lack projects that we tend to become preoccupied with, obsessed with, without knowing what it is that we're, why we feel so obsessed or so, right? And I think number one in the US, come on, let's be realistic here, it's money and all the things that money can buy, right? Consumer toys, as it were, right? We grow up, one of the first things we learn, with very, very few exceptions, I think, we don't have enough money. Not only not enough money, but in a way, it doesn't matter how much you have, because you always need more, right? Especially insofar as our culture glorifies these billionaires, which I find obscene, frankly. You know, this growing gap between rich and poor is really shocking. Money is really fascinating as our primary lack project, especially, right? You think about the functions of money. Necessary means of exchange, also storehouse of value. In the old days, you know, your barn and all the animals in it might burn down, but you've got your gold, right? Gold doesn't burn. It doesn't even tarnish, which is part of the attraction. It seems to have a kind of immortality to it, right? More recently, money has a third function. Let's hear it for corporate capitalism. We can invest our money and make more money. Or just leave it in the bank and get interest. Maybe not very much, but it'll grow, right? It'll breed. But I think money for us serves a fourth function as a lack project. The problem with me is I don't have enough money. The solution will be when I can get enough money. And there's inevitably a kind of a competitive aspect to it, right? The irony is the value we place on money when it's our lack project, it rebounds. There's a kind of karmic rebound. And in a way, we are evaluating ourselves, really, in terms of how much money we have. It's a way of measuring, comparing who we are, right? For a while, I couldn't understand the obsession that some women have with these designer handbags, especially the cost. Oh my, I can't believe it. And of course, you got to carry it so the label's on the outside, right? That's the whole point. What's going on there? And then I realized, of course, right? The point about the handbag, it says something about the me, right? I'm the kind of person who knows. Right? Well, first of all, I can afford to buy it and I know the value. I'm the kind of person who has this kind of handbag. It's all saying something about me, right? Of course, we men, we don't have anything like that, right? Well, maybe our sports cars, something like that. There's a wonderful myth about money that I think it comes from the Greeks, but I think it's even more true now. And I think we all know the story, but it's a really profound one. Midas touch, right? Everyone knows that story. King Midas, supposedly modeled on the famous King Croesus. Anyway, Midas, supposedly incredibly wealthy king, right? And yet he wanted more, never enough. And so he did some boon, some favor to the god Dionysus. So Dionysus said, okay, what can I re how can I return your favor? And Midas says, well, everything, it'd be wonderful if everything I touch turned to gold, right? He had a lot of fun going around his palace until dinner time. Ching. Ching. His little daughter ran across the room. Ching. And he realized maybe this wasn't such a good idea after all. Fortunately for him, the god took away the boon and there's a happy ending. But I think that's a really profound myth about the way money can function for us and how, what's the saying? We can know the price of everything, but we don't appreciate the real value of anything, right? Last night I was having dinner with some friends, right? And we're too cheap to get the really good wine, but I noticed some people next to us, right? These really expensive bottles of wine. I'm the kind of person who knows and enjoys the really good wine. The irony, of course, and this is the problem with all of these lack projects, is that they don't work to resolve the real sense of lack because what they're dealing with is just the symptoms, right? Let me mention just a couple others that I think are really important for us today. Fame. Fame. I think it's a really important one, especially now, right? It wasn't true 1,000 years ago. 1,000 years ago in Europe, fame wasn't an option for most people, right? Most people are peasants. Unless you're the king or the pope or Saint Francis, fame isn't an option, really, right? But what about today, right? It's not just newspapers and magazines and the internet, influencer. Right? The possibilities, on the screens, we tend to see the same people over and over again. Their images keep appearing, right? Again and again, whether we want them to or not. There's the orange-haired one again, right? Come on, you know who I'm talking about there. When the same images keep appearing, There's the sense that, yeah, the society, right, they are the really important people in the culture, in our society. Surely they are real. And if only I could become famous like them, then I would be real. How wonderful to be. And by the way, I've written a lot of books. I want you all to read, buy and read all my books, okay? All right. The idea of lack project of fame, if I can just become famous enough, right? But again, that too doesn't work, of course. And we get these interesting stories of people ruined by fame. It's sort of, they don't know how to deal with it. It doesn't resolve their sense of lack in the way that they thought. In fact, sometimes it makes things worse, right? So I think that's a common lack project, you know, how great to be famous. And often you can translate that into money too, of course, right? Another good example, I'm not sure it works the same way now. I think it worked for my mother's generation. I'm not sure it works for my son's generation. Romantic love, right? By that, I'm referring to a particular way of thinking about relationships. I mean, you know, throughout history everywhere, right? People attracted to each other, make babies, da 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 da. But I'm talking about a specific kind of myth that in the West we can trace back to the story of Tristan and Isolde. We're more familiar with it as Romeo and Juliet. And the myth I'm talking about here is the idea that somewhere out there's this person. And if I can just find that person and we can get together, then it's going to solve the problem of my life, right? We found each other, right? And like all of those, or so many of those fairy tales, right? And they lived happily ever after. Remember that? Well, I think all of us here are old enough to realize it doesn't always work like that, right? In fact, your problems, a different set of problems, might be just beginning. Right? And sometimes part of the problem is the expectations. It's like, you know, not just your lover, your best friend, they've got to, it's like, and that's tough for any person to fill up the sense of lack of another person, right? So those are three kind of classic, I think, lack problems or lack projects. Because without understanding it, I think it's very, very common for people, you know, without having much of a sense of going on, what's going on, to become fascinated, really want to make lots of money, you know, much more than you. I mean, like, no one needs $1 billion, really. No one needs $100 million. Come on. But somehow people get it in their heads, right? Or if I was just famous, I would be somebody, right? What's that line from? Was it Emerson talking about Michelangelo, right? How can he be dead who lives immortal in the hearts of men, right? How wonderful to be so famous, to be living immortal, right? To survive death in that way. Or the perfect partner or power. Does this make sense? Because I think it's really. There's something important here, very much connect with this delusion of a sense of self that's really a kind of a psychological social construct, right? Two problems that I think infect all of those lack projects and indeed lack projects in general, right? The first one to note is how they distort our experience of time. Because our sense of lack means right now I'm not good enough. My life isn't good enough. But in the future, when I have that $1 billion or I have, or I'm famous because you've all bought and read my books, or I found that perfect partner, then my life is going to be okay. So we're constantly devaluing the present simply as a means to get somewhere better. in the future. Sound familiar? Sounds like a lot of types of religion too, right? That's one problem. The other one, which I already mentioned, is the problem of never enough, right? Because money, maybe you think if only I had $1 million or let's say $1 billion, then I'll feel okay. Well, maybe you do get $1 billion, but you don't feel okay. Look, Elon Musk has over 300. It's like, it just goes on and on. And of course, many, many people have pointed this out. Aristotle talked about greed has no end in our Buddhist traditions, right? Greed is the first of the three poisons, right? So I hope you can see the problem. And I find it very kind of illuminating this perspective, right? It's like, it's not death, quite death, a lot of similarities, but it's not just death, the fear of what's going to happen to us in the future. It's that this sense of self is inherently uncomfortable, which we experience as a sense of lack. And so we become obsessed with lack projects, what we think is going to make us feel more secure, more stable, real, right? So I see that as a common problem. Very, it's like once you have this perspective, I have to say, I think it really explains a lot about understanding where people are coming from, where our society is stuck. Because let's be honest, our society glorifies these lack projects, right? They are offered to us. What does it mean to be a human being? What's the meaning of life? Yeah. So what do we do about them? Well, here's where Zen comes in. Now, I think it's important to see that our Zen practice too can be a kind of a lack project, right? It's not only that David Loy is going to be a great world historical immortal philosopher, it's that David Loy is going to get really, really deep enlightenment, and I'm going to become a great Roshi, right? Right? The Buddha, Nagarjuna, Dogen, Hakuin, and David Loy. Right? Right? We can play the same game, and let's be honest, to some extent, there's, right? We easily fall into that, right? We can think of enlightenment as this experience that, oh, suddenly everything is going to be, there's going to be this fantastic transformation, and my life will be perfect and everything will be okay. But at its best, that's not what Zen is talking about. Zen practice offers us a path to resolve the sense of lack by seeing through letting go of the sense of a separate self, right? You see, the sense of self, separate self, repressed, goes along with the sense of lack. You can say they're two sides of the same thing. So, how do you see through the delusion of lack? You see through the delusion of self. And this brings us back to this is one great example, right? The Soto Zen master, Dogen Keigen, 13th century, right? Kamakura period, Japan. And there's this quotation that you probably all know, but I think it's important to remind us of it in this context. From the Shobogenzo, the Genzo Koan, what does Dogen say? Right? Right? To study the Buddha Dharma is to study the self, right? Again, study. We're not talking about university, we're talking about inquire into, right? To study the Buddha Dharma, the way of the Buddha, the path. It's to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to realize your intimacy with the 10,000 things. You could say your non-duality with all things. And to do this, right, is to your body and mind and the body and minds of everyone else fall away, right? What Dogen is really pointing at here is letting go of the sense of self, which is also letting go of the sense of lack. And because it involves this realization of non-duality, that the sense of David Loy in here as this perfect, as this person, this consciousness, somewhere in here behind the eyes, between the ears, looking out at all of you out there, this sense of separation, which includes the sense that my well-being is obviously separate from your well-being, right? The sense of separation, we can say, this is the fundamental delusion, the fundamental problem, right? Delusion, sense of separate self, right? In my tradition, and I think this is not so different from Rinzai generally, my teacher, Yamada Koen, Sambo Zen, Sambo Kyodan, we work on koans, just as in the Rinzai tradition. The first koan for us, Mu, right? And let me just say a few words about that, about how it functions, right? So the idea of Mu, I mean, it's a koan, but basically you treat it as a kind of a mantra. You repeat it. Instead of breath counting or something, you just repeat over, Mu, over and over again, right? With exhalations. This is the way I was taught, right? This is all inside. It's not verbalized usually. But when you exhale, Mu, in your mind, and then when you inhale, you keep the mind steady. So Mu, 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 forever, indefinitely. And how does this work? How does this address our sense of lack? Well, at the beginning, when you're working on Mu, you can say there's three things. There's me trying to focus on Mu, and there's Mu, and then there's all these other thoughts and things that arise, right? Natural. We all know about that. But especially maybe in a session or retreat when we're really focusing, when there are minimal distractions, maybe for several days, we keep saying Mu, keep chanting, reciting this Mu, and the connection with Mu gets stronger so that all the other stuff, it doesn't necessarily all disappear, but it's much lessened, right? It tends to fade. Even if it arises, it kind of goes away by itself very quickly. So you're able to keep this steady stream of consciousness, this focus on Mu. But if you continue, it can get even. So there's two things at that point. There's you and Mu, right? But if you continue, the sense that there's a me that's doing Mu and the sense of Mu as something outside myself, that sense of duality tends to fade away. There's just Mu. Mu. And in Zen, we say, at this point, just Mu. Mu stands up. Mu sits down. Mu meditates. Mu goes to the bathroom. Mu eats. It's just Mu, just Mu, Mu, Mu. Right? Now, that in itself isn't what we might call Kensho or enlightenment, but in the process, it's sort of really priming, as it were, right? I remember, I think it was Shunryu Suzuki of the San Francisco Zen Center. I think it was he who said, enlightenment is always an accident, but meditation, like mooing, makes you accident prone, right? Yeah. So, moo, moo, and we trust the process, so important. Just trust the process. Trust the process. And something happens. We don't make it happen, but sometimes something just happens, and there's this kind of evaporation Like Kensho, okay, it's a taste to some degree, maybe lesser or deeper, but it's this moment of non-dual experience, non-dual insight into the true nature of things, the true non-dual nature of things, right? And then there's, even if it's not very deep, even if it doesn't last very long, there's a sense, there's a memory, there's an understanding. Yes, this is the way, this is the path, and it transforms the context of our practice and helps us as we go along, right? The further koans and so forth. Yeah. Does it make sense? I mean, we could talk a lot more about non-duality. In fact, I wrote a whole book about it, which I hope you'll buy and read. But maybe as a way of, yeah, moving toward a conclusion here. Well, first of all, going back to lack projects, you can see how this letting go of the self is a kind of at least temporary letting go of lack projects, right? When there's no self, there's no lack. There's nothing to gain. There's nothing to gain or lose. There's a real freedom. I don't have to play, play the game of becoming a billionaire or a famous. Yeah, buy my books. No, don't have to play that game. Or wealth, fame, power, perfect partner, whatever. Yeah. So there's a kind of a freedom then. There's nowhere to go, right? Tathata, the Tathagata, the one who just comes and just goes. The other really important thing is, well, let me back up and just say, as long as we have this sense of lack, one metaphor for it, a pretty good metaphor, is the sense that at the core of our consciousness is kind of like a bottomless pit, a hole. Bottomless pit. Bottomless in the sense that doesn't matter how much stuff you put in there, it's never going to fill it up, right? Now, some Buddhist texts talk about paravritti. That's the Sanskrit, paravritti, which literally means turning around, a turning around at the core. And I think that's a way to also understand the kind of awakening that Buddhism is talking about, that when we can let go and stop running away from that hole, there's a transformation. The hole becomes, again, metaphors, right? The hole becomes the place at the core of our being where something greater, it's like, is manifesting. That's not the best way to say it. It's like instead of something that's kind of sucking everything into it, it's the opposite. There's a kind of a spontaneous flow, a fountain. Anybody here like the Grateful Dead? Do you know that song Ripple? Oh, my all-time favorite? Yeah. Ripple in still water where there is no pebble toss, no wind to blow. And there's this great line. It says, there is a fountain that was not made by the hands of men. That fountain is us, right? At the core of our being. It's called creativity. It's called freedom, right? I think many of us experience it. I think many creative people experience it. It's not a laborious sense of the self that creates something, but there's something, I mean, there's a time and a place for that sometimes, but so often when you read stories about poets or musicians, especially, how it just came to them. It's just like they weren't trying to, it just sort of flowed, right? the flow state. And maybe many of us have a little taste of that. Sometimes, like when I lie down to go to sleep, if I've been thinking about some problem, that I'm lying and then suddenly the thought pops up, right? Anybody have that experience, right? And one thing I've learned, I have to write it down because it ain't going to be there in the morning, right? And sometimes the one thought leads to a lot of other thoughts. I'm like, oh, I got to get up, turn on the light, make a note. Oh, again. And sometimes it goes on quite a while. I get kind of tired, but if I don't write it down, it's gone. And sometimes those are really fascinating thoughts. But that, I think, is a taste of non-duality, the sense of it's not this separate self that's doing something, but it's more spontaneous, like the great athlete, totally one with his or her body, right? And also perceptually, too. Let me just give one example. Most of us love music, some form or other. For me, it's mostly classical. And once in a great while, usually when it's my wife is gone so I can turn crank up the volume, right? And I'll be listening to the music, and then something happens. It's like I'm absorbed into the music. There's no longer a sense of me that's listening to the music. There's just the music, right? T.S. Eliot said, "Music heard so deeply that there is no music, but you are the music while it lasts." Right? And it's wonderful. It's just like you've become the music in a way. And then eventually, usually fairly soon, there's a bit of a dawning of self-consciousness. And I start to realize, oh, this is wonderful, how much I'm enjoying it. And of course, at that point, there's a sense of duality. And then at that point, I realize, oh no, I'm losing it. So I want to hold. And of course, then it's gone, right? Right? So, and it's important. We can't make those moments happen. But certainly with our practice and with certain relaxation, they're more likely to happen. But it's a taste of, this non-duality of our true self that, David isn't in here. It's how all of this is coming together. And to conclude, a very important aspect of this transformation at the core is from, self-preoccupation to the bodhisattva path, right? As long as I have this sense of lack, right? David isn't good enough. I've got to be rich and famous or whatever. Well, obviously, there's a lot of self-preoccupation. It's about me. I have this suffering, this discomfort, and I'm looking for something that's going to work, that's going to make me feel okay, right? And so, inevitably, a certain kind of selfishness there. But with the kind of transformation that Zen talks about, this letting go of ourselves, realizing our non-duality, there's a kind of a natural shift. I remember my teacher, Yamada Koen Roshi, saying, actually, one of the criteria, one of the ways that a Kensho is genuine is that there's a spontaneous arising of compassion, right? And a shift from what's in it for me to, hey, I'm part of all you, I'm part of all this. What can I do? What, given who I am, what can I do to make this a better world for all of us? And the short term for that is the bodhisattva path. And what I find interesting about that is, just because one has that experience, it doesn't mean our old self-centered, self-preoccupied habits automatically disappear, right? They're still there. But the opportunity in the bodhisattva path is by trying to follow that as much as we can, it's also transforming us. In other words, I think the one who benefits most from the Bodhisattva path is the Bodhisattva herself, because it's actualizing that realization, right? What's that great quotation from Nisargadatta? My all-time favorite quotation, and I'll bet I said it 8 years ago too. When I look inside and see that I am nothing, that's wisdom. When I look outside and see that I am everything, that is love. Between these two, my life flows. Wisdom and love. And his point is really, they're not two different things, right? Wisdom is insight, and what we call love is, it's not just a feeling, it's a way of living in the world. It's a way of relating to other people and the earth that embodies this wisdom of non-separation, of non-duality. So they're really two sides of the same thing. And next time in 2 weeks, I'll talk about more about that, especially the eco-sattva, the ecological application of the Bodhisattva path. Thank you very much.